Hello, fellow dot. I messed it up. I was so excited. I came out of the gates.
That's wow. That didn't take.
I never do this. And I'm like literally so excited. This is Imani's line. I'm stepping all over it. Hello, fellow law nerds, and welcome to a special episode of Boom Lawyered, a Rewire News Group podcast hosted by the legal journalism team that's flying solo this week while Imani recovers from COVID. Get well, Imani. I'm Rewire News Group's SVP and executive editor, Jess Piclo, and this week, with Imani out, I asked a very special guest to join me. Author, activist, and all-around abortion access badass, Robin Marty is here. Dear friend, Robin, welcome to the show.
I'm not a badass. You're a badass.
You're the badass,
no,
Robin.
You're the badass.
First of all, is this the first time that I've actually like interviewed you? We've known each other for an eternity, but I think this might be the first time where I have you in the hot seat.
Yeah, I think usually I'm the one who is yelling at you and asking you questions. And also sometimes I interview you too. Usually I'm just yelling at you and asking you questions.
This is the greatest. I'm going to try and be responsible with this great power and responsibility that I have been given right now. But the truth be told, I am like crawling out of my skin so excited to talk to you in this capacity. You've been doing abortion rights and access work in this space for honestly damn near longer than anybody else, probably longer than anybody else. And your book, The Handbook for a Post-Roe America, is a must read for anybody and everybody right now, not just folks who are interested and activated by this particular moment, but for literally like every human on the planet. Go out and read Robin's book.
Go read Robin's book. Always do what Jessica says. That's what I've learned in our 15 years of friendship, something like that, maybe more.
This is wild, like decades. But I want to talk this week with you about the post-Dobbs reality, right? We're a couple weeks out from the leak of the Alito memo, which was a big gut punch. And I mean, first of all, let me ask, like, what did you think when you saw that?
So I didn't see it at first, which was really interesting. People would probably be shocked to find out that running an abortion clinic in a state like Alabama is really draining. And so I try to actually not abortion in any way, shape, or form once I am out of the clinic. I spend time with my kids. I make dinner. I play a lot of Sudoku. And I'm going to be honest, I was in bed playing Sudoku and just unwinding, and all of a sudden my phone exploded. Mm. And it was reporter after reporter after reporter. What do you think of this? Did you see this? What did you think of this? And I didn't entirely know what was going on and was reading it when my phone actually started ringing. And it was one of my clinic staff. It was my clinic director who called me up and said, "Are we closed?"
Yeah.
Because we have been preparing for the moment that the Dobbs decision comes down in a frantic sort of way that I don't think every clinic has to deal with. Because even when you have states that have trigger laws where a decision that Roe v. Wade is overturned means that abortion will become illegal, there's still trigger laws. There is something that has to happen in between that moment that will make this happen. So, for example, I believe South Dakota has to wait until their next legislative session. Mississippi is supposed to have the AG go to the governor, or there's little pieces.
So there's like administrative stuff that happens.
So they have a buffer. Like I tell people this, I would kill for a 24-hour buffer, like 24 hours of, okay, deal with this, and then it's banned. We don't have that in Alabama. In Alabama, we have a 1850-something pre-Roe. Abortion is completely criminalized. The person who provides the abortion, also potentially, according to our lawyers, the person who receives the abortion, can be fined or put in jail. And the only thing that makes this not enforceable right now is Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. So you take away Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court says specifically Roe v. Wade is now reversed, is now gone, should never have been, however they decide to put it. That exact moment is the moment that abortion can be criminalized, and any person who has one or does one can end up in jail. So for us specifically, that means that we are preparing paperwork to make sure that any person who comes in on a decision day understands that just by signing in, just by filling out their paperwork, just by making their payment, that does not mean that they are guaranteed an abortion mm-hmm. because we open at 8 and the decision will come down sometime after 9 and they could be sitting in an exam room. And if we haven't started, they have to go home.
Okay, Robin, that all sounds like a nightmare. But I also realize that there are folks who are listening to this podcast that maybe don't even know that you help run an abortion clinic in Alabama. What are you doing? What don't you do for abortion is the better question. No, but truly, talk to what's your role? This is such an evolution and like beautiful. What are you doing?
So let's talk really fast about my abortion origin story, if you will.
I love this.
I was born on a planet called Krypton. No. So I started out actually working with this wonderful woman. Her name was Jessica Mason Piclo at a little news site that was known as RH Reality Check. I don't know whatever happened to that. That's a joke. It's Rewire News, people. Back then, Jess and I worked together and we tracked legislation, state-based legislation. This was my reporting gig. And when I left there, after having written this amazing book that then was rewritten about a year and a half ago and is now available as The End of Roe v. Wade, I highly recommend it. This wonderful woman named Jessica Mason Piclo also co-wrote that with me. I'm just going to sit here and like make you shine. So after I left Rewire News, my background was doing freelance reporting primarily on abortion access, but also on the anti-abortion movement.
Yep.
I did that for years and then Trump was elected, 2019 happened, everything hit the fan. When Anthony Kennedy in 2018 said that he was going to be retiring from the Supreme Court, everybody went into a panic with what are we going to do? Roe's going to be overturned. And they gave some really bad ideas of things to do, like, hey, I'm going to give all my money to Planned Parenthood, which anybody who knows me, let me tell you, probably laughed. So I immediately started telling people on Twitter, you know, when it comes to abortion access, Planned Parenthood is not the place to give mm-hmm. your resources because in states that don't have much in the way of clinics, those aren't Planned Parenthoods. Those are independent abortion yeah. clinics. Don't stockpile emergency contraception. If you stockpile it, you're taking it off the shelves for people who actually need it. All of this turned into a very long Twitter thread that turned into a Huffington Post article that turned into the first version of Handbook for Post-Roe America. When that started getting popular and then Alabama passed the first complete abortion ban. So when we say complete abortion ban, it's from the moment of conception. It does not have any exceptions for sexual assault, for fetal anomaly, for any sort of physical harm to a pregnant person, only an exception if the life is literally in danger at that moment. That is mm-hmm. the only time that you can have an abortion. And when that happened, that was when I hit a wall. And I realized that this was too important to just be, not just. Just is not, because obviously reporting is very, very important and is key to all of this. But
you wanted to do more. You wanted to do something to do more. That's a legitimate thing to say. I don't take offense to that.
I wanted to activist. And also, let's be fair, there are many, many good reporters out there. And there aren't a lot of people who are going to say, hey, you know what? Let's really get involved in abortion access in Alabama.
Yeah.
So I started working for the Yellowhammer Fund as their communications director. And soon after that, Yellowhammer Fund purchased an abortion clinic. It was the largest abortion clinic in the state of Alabama. And at that time, Alabama had 3. We are also back to 3 because Planned Parenthood stopped providing abortions down here. See point number 1 about Planned Parenthood. And that abortion clinic provided 50% of the abortions for the state of Alabama. And the person who owned it wanted to retire. And the doctor wanted to retire. And if that clinic closed, that would decimate abortion access, not mm-hmm. just in Alabama, but in Mississippi, which only has 1 clinic, in Louisiana, which only has 3 clinics. They're in the Florida Panhandle, where there's only 1 clinic. So the Yellowhammer Fund purchased the clinic to keep it open. I moved over there to do their communications. And then when things got rough, I took over all of the operations because I was still there and I was not medical and somebody had to run it. So that's my origin story of how I then picked up my entire family, my husband, my three children, and we moved from lovely, liberal Minneapolis, Minnesota down to warm, not liberal Alabama, Tuscaloosa.
So here's a fun fact for our listeners that they may not know. Robin and I actually grew up less than 15 miles from each other.
That is
true. Omaha, Nebraska. Woo! Did not know each other at all in Nebraska. Went to different high schools, although literally like just borderland high schools, different, you know, like I was, which Millard were you at? North?
I was Millard South.
You're Millard South. Okay. You're Millard South. I was at West Side. So like warring factions there for the folks who know Omaha. And then it was on Twitter that we met, and I believe it was a Runza joke, also very regional specific, that clued me in that Robin was from Omaha. Runzas are like, I don't know, they're like pierogies, kind of. Anyway, none of that is relevant, except that we ended up meeting on Twitter, doing abortion stuff together, and like, yet here we were, like, you know, spending our childhoods, like, so close to each other. It's just, that always cracks me up. All right.
For the boomed lawyer people, I just want to let them understand that before there was Imani, there was Robin. I try not to be intensely jealous of Imani, but I was Jess's first work wife. We used to travel together.
We did.
It was a glorious thing. And I'm happy that she's found happiness with another person, but like the jilted lover, I cry at night sometimes.
No. We're a good working throuple. That's how it goes. Oh, this is awesome. Okay. What's not awesome is the first 90 days after the Dobbs decision drops. Truly, though, like, you know, one of the silver linings, I think, of the Alito memo leak is that for folks who had been marginally paying attention or who had been coming in and out of attention, the reality of what the conservative justices are planning for this country could no longer be avoidable. And there's the possibility that there may be some changes around the margins, but we really have to take what Sam Alito leaked, or what was leaked in the Sam Alito memo. I'm not going to say he was the leaker. But we have to take that seriously. And as so that's what's coming. And, you know, you just described the very dire situation in Alabama and, as you know, the entire Southeast, really. But from your vantage point, both as somebody who is in the provider space and as somebody who has tracked these issues and also the anti-choice movement for well over a decade now, what do those first 90 days after the decision drops, what do they look like for you?
So it's going to be a scramble for every provider, obviously. What we are going to see in the Southeast, especially, is the fact that we are going to see a series of probably clinic closures or clinic struggles. What people don't understand about this region is that it is the least amount of Planned Parenthoods in the United States. So, for instance, there's one in Mississippi, there's two in Alabama, there's one in Louisiana. And the issue with this is not the abortion end of things as much as it is the fact that this is an area that has no access to contraception. Mm-hmm. The entirety of it has so far, I shouldn't say it opted out, its governors and its leadership opted out of Obamacare. So they have never expanded Medicaid. There is no access to free birth control. For the most part, the only place that people can get birth control is for without insurance or without seeing a doctor is in their county health department. There's one county health department per county, regardless of the spread of the county or how many people are in it. For things like long-lasting birth control, implants, IUDs, you have to wait until there is a doctor who is available to come in who will actually do them. So we see people who wait months, like four or 5 months, in order to get an appointment for birth control. So there is not access to preventing pregnancies to start with. And once you take out abortion clinics, which are also one of the sole places where people can get contraception as well, then it's only going to be that much worse. Mississippi and Alabama, currently half of all pregnancies that happen in their state are unplanned. I'm not saying unwanted, because people do decide that they're going to carry them to term, but they are not planned. They are not people who are trying to get pregnant. Also, we have 30 to 37, depending on which state, maternal mortality per 10,000 births. I always forget how the maternal mortality index is. But so it's number 4 and number 6, I believe, in maternal mortality in the nation. This is a healthcare crisis that we are already in. It is one that is only going to get that much worse. And it's one that, honestly, the entire national movement is ignoring, because every bit of resources that exists at this moment is being pledged towards states that are going to be receiving people. So it's towards opening new clinics in states where they can do that. It's towards getting money to abortion funds and practical support groups to make sure that people who are in these red states can get somewhere to be able to access care. But that doesn't really address the marginalized people. And we are going to see the same sort of system as we saw pre-Roe, where people with ability and privilege are going to be able to access abortion by leaving, but we're just changing what that level of privilege is. People in Alabama struggle to get to my clinic across the city. They struggle because it takes days to have 2 appointments, to be able to find childcare, to be able to find the money. There is no amount of money that can be thrown at this problem that is going to get certain people out of the state in order to get an abortion. And what happens to them? Yeah. Where do they go? What do they do? That's why we're trying to keep our clinic open, regardless of what happens. But we know that without abortion, this is something that will rely almost entirely on donations, on grants, on people caring about what happens to the poorest and the blackest and brownest people in our nation. And we don't have a good track record of caring about that.
Yeah, so it really becomes relegated even further into a charity economy, which never works well when we're talking about delivering healthcare. So one of the things that Imani and I hear from a lot from listeners of this show is functionally, what can I do, right? Like, this is all bad. The courts are clearly screwed and making the problem worse. What can I do? And so, you know, you wrote an entire book about what people can do.
How much time
truly.
Do you have?
but no, so I'm only going to ask for 3 things. Like, what are 3 practical things that our listeners could do today to help better prepare for this post-Dobbs reality that we are going to walk into that you just laid out?
Okay, number 1, financially or otherwise, resource red states, resource their organizations, resource their independent clinics, resource them in any way that you can to provide support. Number 2, there is a piece of legislation that exists that's known as the Pregnant Person Dignity Act, and Jessica will put some sort of link somewhere, I assume, in order to make people be able to access it. The one thing that we are hearing politicians say over and over and over again is, we do not want to criminalize the person who is having an abortion. They swear they don't want to put them in jail. They keep saying this. So take it to your local city council, to the state legislature, wherever you need to take it, and make them vote on this. It essentially says that because healthcare does not exist for all people, because the people who are unable to access healthcare are the ones who are the most likely to have the worst pregnancy outcomes, and because we know that both our judicial and police system and our hospital systems are inherently racist, that the people who are Black and brown and poor are going to be the ones who are the most likely to be investigated for any sort of non-live birth, regardless of whether it was an abortion or was just a simple miscarriage. This is a way for every person who is capable of becoming pregnant to be protected legally if they do not have a live birth. And if Republicans are actually being honest, which if Republicans are actually being
honest,
my
face is doing a lot of work right
now. Yeah, it is. If Republicans are actually being honest in their declarations that they're not going to put somebody who did their own abortion in jail, then they should be supporting this legislation as well, because that is exactly what they say they want. So that's number 2. And number 3, this is actually the best time to put pressure on GOP legislators. Usually I don't say that, but I am already seeing here in Alabama the fact that the same person who introduced the total abortion ban and not only introduced it, but threatened to pull it if they put in an exception for rape and incest, she is now going around saying that in the next legislative session, she's going to introduce a heartbeat ban instead to get it replaced. And while we all in this sphere know that a heartbeat ban is essentially a total abortion ban anyway, there are still tiny little places where we can work with that. And if this shows nothing else, it's that people, Republicans are already getting scared. They don't want to have to face the repercussions of these laws that they have been pushing so hard for the last couple of years. And they've been doing it with the assumption that they would always stay enjoined and they wouldn't ever have to face the consequences. They're starting to hear about the consequences now. So this is the best time to apply pressure.
That is super interesting to me. I would not have necessarily anticipated that they would be open to listening.
There is so much fighting going on in Alabama right now over whether exceptions should be allowed or not. And it's glorious to watch.
So, all right, kind of a flip side of this. And you hinted at this in, a little bit of your exposition about what it's like to try and be a provider in access care in the Southeast. But what are some policies that progressives either could or should really rally around, and not just to like respond to this moment? But one of the things I am really thinking about is, how do we build something better?
Universal health care. I cannot be any more clear how badly we need health insurance down here. Sat in on the most atrocious call about Medicaid yesterday. That was essentially the people in the Medicaid system explaining how there's something called the unraveling, which is apparently the attempt to get all of the people who managed to get Medicaid because of expansions from COVID back off the rolls. And this was this moment where I realized that the amount of money that's being spent trying to prevent people from stealing Medicaid is actually probably more than would be spent on actual medical care. And so we know medicine is a business and it should not be a business. And there is nothing more important right now than making sure that it's not just about reproductive health care access. Every person deserves the ability to be healthy, regardless of what their income level is, their race, where they live, any of these things. So this is our rallying point. This is where we all need to get behind. 60% of Alabamians believe that Medicaid should be expanded.
Alabamians.
It's true. And the only reason why this hasn't happened, honestly, is because our governor is afraid that she'll lose the primary if she does it. Because that 40% is the most rabid of the MAGAs.
And Medicaid expansion is one of those things that is boring to talk about. It is like, it's insurance, it's musty, it's dusty in terms of like, you know, the language that we have to use around it. But in terms of impact,
and it doesn't need to be boring and musty. Like, every person knows somebody who has a story about being almost bankrupted by a hospital bill.
Yeah.
And that's where we go. That's what we tell. Everybody, it's like the abortion. Everybody has an abortion story. Everybody knows somebody who has had a medical health issue. And so why is this so hard to become unified on?
I mean, it's and you're completely right. I mean, just thinking back to my own abortion origin story, I came into this via the affordable healthcare fight, right? At the time when Robin and I first met, I was at the Health Law Institute at Hamline University School of Law as the assistant director. And my job was to track the Affordable Care Act in every iteration out of committee. And guess what became a big hot button issue in the fight over the Affordable Care Act?
Abortion. Let the record reflect, jazz hands. Abortion.
And here we are. Here we are. So, you know, as Monty likes to say, abortion is healthcare, motherfucker. And the flip side of that is that all healthcare is a fundamental right, including abortion. So,
yep.
Well, somehow, Robin, we have managed to blow about 25 minutes just bullshitting with each other.
somehow. Like, we don't do that all the time.
This is so first of all, thank you for your time. I mean, I literally took you away from providing care for Alabamians right now so that you could talk to folks on this show who may have no idea what that is like. And so I appreciate you giving us their time and attention and away from the very critical work that you're doing right now. And then selfishly also, it was just so lovely to see you and talk to you again, because I do miss you. We don't see each other nearly enough.
I could not have been more delighted.
Stupid pandemic.
And it's just makes me sad that I had to move all the way to Alabama and provide abortions in order to finally get an invite to Boom Lawyered.
Hey, to be fair, we don't have guests. But so you got the very special seat. That said, you're coming back. We have so much more to talk to you about. And this is just, it's too good. And you are a wealth of knowledge and resources that I want our listeners to have access to. Everybody, read Robin's book, support her work. This is an important time, you know, and just thank you for giving your time, attention to us, to our listeners, and to the people of this country. You are a national treasure who needs to be celebrated. Yay, Robin Marty, everybody.
Thank you.
And on that note, I don't have Imani here to see me out, so I will see myself out and say, folks, you can find us on our socials, right? Rewire News Group, Instagram, Twitter. I'm Hegemami. Robin is, what's your Twitter handle?
Robin Marty.
Follow Robin if you don't for all sorts of stuff. Imani, get well, come back. I clearly should not be handled the controls all to myself. Our producer, Mark Folletti, has been facepalming most of this time. And for everybody else, I will see you on the tubes, folks.
Boom Lawyered is created and hosted by Jessica Mason Piglow and Imani Gandhi. Mark Folletti produces the show.